Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Ian Punnett for night two on a fun weekend for me, anyway, on Coast to Coast AM, because my old friend Mary Roach is back. Her new book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. It's, of course, entertaining. It is, of course, informative. As a science writer who's very funny, that's the inevitable convergence with anything that Mary Roach does. Highly entertaining science writing. In this case, however, I think she exceeds expectations. The best work, I got this book as a galley about 8 weeks ago, and I've been reading it poolside, if you will, you know, just kind of hanging out in the summer, catching it. And it's funny how much of my lens on the wildlife around me changed as I was reading this book, because there are so many attempts that we make as human beings to control animals through the law. Which is seemingly such an absurd concept, but not even just the law, like, you know, all of the different agencies that are out there policing nature, but all of the other attempts that are private and, non-governmental, but still essential to try to curb populations, animal populations that are out of control from our perspective. From the human, not from the animal's perspective, they're not out of control. They're doing great. It's so entertaining. We'll get to this coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. You don't want to miss it. But first hour, we have a couple of big anniversaries. So Bryce Zabel, who's an extraordinary producer for television, will mark his 25th anniversary for the creation of Dark Skies, which I think we can all relate to here as Coasties. But more than that, he's got other projects, and I want to talk to him about the paranormal space that exists in television, especially in the based on a true story portion. And that's also another anniversary we're celebrating with the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. Those two stories lurk out there, and yet we won't get to that until we talk to M.L. Behrman. You've heard ML. He's been on Coast to Coast many times. He is described in our bio sheet as a desert enthusiast. Not something you hear people say very often. And yet he sort of divested a little bit of the Mojave, which has been the center point of all of his creative output in the last couple of decades. And he has had a chance to visit Roswell, which gave him an interesting perspective on something that he saw once in the desert in the Mojave, which he's here to share with us next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I'm looking forward to talking about Dark Skies with Bryce Zabel coming up a little bit later on this hour. Couldn't pass up that opportunity, nor could I miss a chance to get caught up with our friend in the first hour here, M.L. Behrman, who has, how do you want to describe it? Did you sell your house in the middle of the desert, or did you buy another one? Are you leaving the Mojave? Because that's just wrong.
No, not at all. I mean, the prices out here were insane, and some lady offered me a barrel of cash, and so I took it, and I decided to do overlanding for like 6 months and just put a rig together and go out and explore and work on my stories from a mobile perspective.
I love that. And yes, that I totally get that when they come knocking on your door and they've got a little trailer, it's got cash in it. Those opportunities don't come along every day. So terrific turn of events for you, but that also turns it into something cool for us, because one of the things you did is you went down to Roswell, ML, and I don't know whether your visit's going to be used in your upcoming Mojave Mysteries series or what you plan on doing with it. I am curious, what did you actually find when you went to visit the city of Roswell, and what were you trying to get out of it?
Well, it was actually my second time there. I went out in 1997 for the 50th anniversary of the crash.
Sure.
And so alleged crash.
Right.
And the opinion I formed of it was like, wow, this is really commercialized. A lot of people are making money off this. And some of the stories were just a little too simplistic to me. And that was my initial impression. Now, working out here, I've been working on a story where I ran into elements that kind of dovetailed back to Roswell. And so I went back out there to look at some of what the proof is in their museum, some people there. And specifically, I was interested in the government's angle on it, which, without regurgitating the whole Roswell thing, which everyone I'm sure knows.
No, but I think a thumbnail is good for this context, yeah.
Right. So the government said that what it really was a super secret Project Mogul, which where they were launching balloons into the high atmosphere in order to take samples to see if the Russians were blowing off nuclear weapons on the other side of the world and the fallout was blown this way and we'd know how far their atomic program was. And that the foil dome was for the radar to track it, and that's what people found and misinterpreted as a flying saucer. And anyway, you know the whole pedigree that grew from that. Right. Now, what I was specifically interested in was this idea of the secret government program that was testing radiation, because it dovetails back to a story I've been working on out here that I have personal experience with, and I'll give you the background on that real quick. Like 10 years ago, I was doing what I usually like to do sometimes is look on Google Satellite for weird formations in the desert, and then I mark them, and I go out and investigate.
I love
and
that.
I had found this weird little mountain that sat in a remote valley overlooking the Pinot Basin Wilderness area near Joshua Tree. And it had the weirdest appearance. It was dark, and it had what looked like layers, like a layer cake, like a ziggurat pyramid, step pyramid, and a little goat trail that wound through the mountains to get to it. I'm like, I wonder what this is. So I went out there, and it was a hell of a trail to get into it. Anyway, I found the mountaintop in this remote valley, and sure enough, bulldozers had totally sculpted it, but I mean years ago, because the place had eroded, and there were pipes sticking out of the ground like they were venting something, like you'd see them venting methane at a landfill or something.
Right, exactly.
But this is out in the middle of the desert, and I'm like, I don't know what the hell this is, and I couldn't find anything in the mining data that looked like it was related. So over the next couple of years, friends and I would go out there and we'd camp, we'd picnic overnight. And, you know, camp is a great place for sky watching and all that. So then 5 years went by. We hadn't gone out there. We decided to go out there. And just as we're turning into the ravine that where you start up the trail to the top, it's blocked by a government truck. And we get out. Now, most government officials you run into in the backcountry are BLM, you know, Bureau of Land Management.
Right, and right.
This was the Department of the Interior, and they had a radar dome on the truck, and there was no one to be seen.
Stop for just a second. So explain for the uninitiated the difference right there in the badging between BLM and Department of Interior. Why was that significant? For a lot of people to be like, oh, it's just another alphabet agency.
Right. Well, BLM tends to deal with everything from archaeological finds to grazing to land use to water use, more natural resource oriented. The Department of the Interior, and I said this when I saw the sign on the truck, handles atomic energy, nuclear weapons, stuff like that. So it's not something you expect to find out in the Mojave in an old mining district, right?
Right.
It's not land managers. This is government, something to do with energy. And it had, like I say, a radar dome on the top, which I couldn't understand that. Now, there was no one to be seen, and they had blocked the trail, so we did a little landscaping, got around them, and went up the trail and got up to the top of this mountain. And you come around a little hairpin turn on a goat trail, and there's the mountain. So we come around up there. And here's two guys in hazmat suits with Geiger counters and some big gizmo, and they're checking the ground where we had been camping previously, right?
Right.
With now, a Geiger. You gotta imagine, yeah. these guys look like something out of an Austin Powers movie, and we look like something out of Mad Max because we're like, you know, bandanas and goggles.
Sure.
Covered with dirt. And we roll up on them, and the first thing they say to us is, how the hell did you guys get up here? And we're like, well, we got Jeeps. That's what we do.
Right.
And they were like, wow, you know, we had to carry all our gear up here. And so we asked them, like, well, what are you guys doing? And they were actually very nice. They go, we're taking readings because this is a highly radioactive rare earth mine that the government put to sleep 70 years ago. And it's, so we're like, oh, you mean like radiation? And they're like, yeah, that's what these tubes are venting is radiation from the ground. And, you know, this area is hot, so you can only be up here for a half hour without a suit on. And we're like, dude, we spent the night up here.
Yeah, thanks for telling us.
Yeah, there was no signs. And believe me, there's no signs anywhere about this place. I mean, the government put it to sleep for sure. So they were like, oh, yikes. And so we're like, well, how bad did we get dosed? And they couldn't tell us. And I later found out from the Atomic Energy Commission site that we got equal to a good chest x-ray for every 24 hours we were up there.
Okay.
And so we said, well, what's the deal with, you know, this? And I go, well, a while ago, 70 years ago, we mapped, the government mapped rare earth deposits across the West. And rare earth is used in sensitive electronics, batteries, stuff like that.
Sure.
At that time, we didn't have that industry, but now that is a huge part of the defense industry.
Huh.
He said we've been getting most of our stuff from China, but since things are deteriorating with China, we've got to reopen our own thing so we're not dependent on them for strategic metals, which I thought was pretty cool for a guy to tell you just out of the blue,
right,
you know, in the middle of
almost like it's public information and anybody could know this, but you get a feeling like if this is public information, or maybe just exists between, it's public, but no, they don't want to talk about it, but they also don't want to try and go through the effort of trying to, you know, secrete it away from the public.
Well, I asked him, I go, look, if this place, I can understand all that. If this place is so hot, why isn't there a sign that says, you know, radiation, danger, whatever? And he goes, well, quite frankly,
don't sleep here.
We didn't think anyone was crazy enough to come out here. You know,
I hadn't met M.L. Behrman.
And we were like, dude, clearly you don't know desert inhabitants.
Exactly. So, let me stop you just for a second. So already, how does that experience, just even what we've – and that reminds me by – in some ways, that reminds me a little bit of the premise of the old TV series Dark Skies, this is the 25th anniversary. And it's kind of the same idea about a couple that's trying to expose the truth about a hidden alien invasion, as opposed to the one that everybody knew about. Like, if you had to, like, everybody, if you say alien invasion, a lot of people just reflexively say, well, Roswell, New Mexico. But I'm always interested in the places they don't tell you about. It's all the places that we'll never hear the names of. Those are the ones that seem to me to be the hot spots where something happened and the government is just like doing its thing, just kind of quietly out of the way, and they're not drawing any attention to it, just like what you experienced. So how do those two things rub together for you?
Well, that's the thing. Now, we had nicknamed this place Metal Flake Mountain because the minerals looked like someone sprayed it with gold metal flake paint.
Really?
I went and researched once we left. How'd they find this place? Okay, remember I said Project Mogul from Roswell?
Right.
They were running the same program at the same time out here in the Mojave. And they weren't using balloons. They were using planes. And they were flying super high and taking samples out of the upper atmosphere and, you know, running it over a Geiger counter actually in the plane. Flew over this area, it pegged their needles so much they went, where the hell is this coming from? The ground, not the sky. And that's when they sent in the people
to get the rare earth
bulldozers and did all the stuff and all that. So they found it through this Project Mogul.
Oh, that's so interesting. Right.
Now, a strange story goes weird right here. If you stand on Metal Flake Mountain and look across the valley of the Pinot Basin, along the same geographical fault and drainage area. 3 miles away is what is called the Barry Storm UFO Jade Mine. And I've done a story about this on my channel. If you go to YouTube and check, you can see a video on it. And Barry Storm was a guy at the same time, 1947, 48, who was prospecting down there. And he said three UFOs, specifically saucers, converged over a small hill and pointed a light down and told them to dig there. And he dug there. And he found not radioactive materials. He found what he said was jade, you know, gem stones. But
right.
It was a weak form of jade. But anyway, it was enough that he filed a claim. He spent the next 30 years of his life out there working this claim and having visitors. And he claimed that for those 30 years, UFOs would come back occasionally, and the men in black from the government would come back occasionally and hassle him about, have you seen lights? Have you seen UFOs out here? Have you seen, you know, people working the ground, whatever? Now, you put that down to like, oh, crackpot been in the sun way too long. But just a little while a distance away, the men in black, per se, were doing Metal Flake Mountain and strategic minerals and Atomic Energy Commission tests and all sorts of things. Now, you go along the same line from Metal Flake to the UFO mine. You go 3 miles past him, same line. That's the area where in 1952, although he claimed it, 48, it happened. A man named George Adamski said a UFO directed him to come out and meet them there. And he went out and met a UFO and its inhabitants or pilot. And that was the start of the contactee phenomenon in American popular culture, modern popular culture.
Right.
And so now you've got two big UFO things linked along the same line with this other thing. Now, what did the aliens tell George Adamski? They told him, stop spreading radioactive material into the atmosphere. Stop using atomic bombs. Stop doing nuclear testing. I mean, all the classic 50s stuff. And he described the aliens from Venus, Venusians, as like 7 foot tall blonde people, like Nordic, you know, perfect people from some Swedish swim team at or something. You know, it wasn't the reptilian or any of that. Now, let's go back to Metal Flake Mountain. If you go the opposite direction along the same line, you run into Giant Rock. And Giant Rock, and I've done stories on that too, is a place that has an almost cult-like following that has a history of paranormal, weird energy, and UFO stuff since Native American times. And an individual out there named George Van Tassel said a UFO came down and gave him information how to build this gizmo, which he built that still stands out there, called the Integratron. And the government visited him. Howard Hughes used to come visit him. I mean, a whole panoply of personalities. All along this one fault line, all along the same timeline. And actually, George Adamski and him got together and used to hold yearly UFO conventions at Giant Rock. So what you have in this one whole area at the same time frame is the absolute genesis of the American popular UFO movement. Now, you tie in Roswell. How? Well, that was a government secret program checking on radiation was their cover story. Now, all the other weirdness that is associated with it, I can't speak to because that's not really my thing. I just find it fascinating that what I was looking at, their cover story, all of a sudden I find evidence of it out here, but then the tie-in with all this other UFO activity. And you ask, well, what's the underlying causal threads or at least underlying synchronicity? And what do you have? You got the desert, you got the radiation, and you've got the government secret programs or government involvement somehow.
Yeah.
Now, if I
and the government quick, head fake too, you know, which comes into, but we, so we have 30 seconds.
Sure. If you go back 150 years, old prospectors said that they used to be able to see uranium in the night deposits because of ghost lights, or spook lights, they call them, which were like orbs and discharges in the ground. So the whole weirdness associated with this rare earth radioactivity and paranormal activity has a long pedigree, longer than what the conventional one is. And this whole classic period of UFOs from the end of World War II up to the Betty and Barney Hill thing,
right?
You know, where it turned from the desert to something a lot more darker in different parts of the country.
I loved every second of this, and I thank you so much for taking our invitation. It's the perfect setup for our visit with Bryce Zabel before Mary Roach on the way. M.L. Behrman, link up to him and his Western Paranormal Fiction 2 at our website, coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. You know, it's just the coolest of stories that M.L. Behrman was telling, but at the same time, I kept thinking about the fact that this was a real experience for so many other people that then gets fictionalized in various films and, you know, TV series, not unlike Dark Skies. The fact that we bump up against the weirdest governmental clandestine activity all the time. This is an ongoing subject on Coast to Coast, has been forever, is the institutional awareness, seemingly, of some of the strangest things that happen. The idea of men in black coming to visit this guy in the desert, lights that shine on areas where he's supposed to be digging, messages that are passed along that are not hidden. He's been telling these stories out in the open. He doesn't end up in a jail somewhere. Everybody just sort of said, well, you know, let him tell those stories. And so it's so much of what I think of, and I often wonder about it when I went through Roswell, is it wasn't the Roswell incident itself. It seemed like the government was more than happy to let people talk about that. And I think, well, if they're perfectly happy letting everybody talk about Roswell and all of its uncertainties and seeming contradictions in some aspects of the story, et cetera, what else are they not telling us? Right? It's kind of a head fake. The government saying, yeah, go ahead, talk about Roswell all you want. The serious stuff was happening somewhere else. That's what I often think about. It's another reason why I love the work of Bryce Zabel, and we'll talk with him coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I will tell you again, Mary Roach on the way just after the top of the hour. You're going to love the show tonight. Fuzz is her new book, When Nature Breaks the Law. It's so entertaining. But so is the work of Bryce Zabel, who joins us on Coast to Coast to commemorate a couple of things. But mostly, Bryce, I want to say you kind of fell into my lap at the last minute. And sometime I'd love to reserve the right to have you come back and be a guest on in a longer form, if that's something you'd be willing to do sometime in the future. Did I lose Bryce? Michael?
Ian, you got me?
Oh, there I go. Hey, yeah, you are. Thank you so much.
Overcoming these technical obstacles one after another here. Hey,
I was afraid you got abducted. I was a little afraid you got abducted, so I'm good.
That would be a good narration. You could fill the time with that, and that would be great. I'm happy to be here tonight, and, you know, I come back anytime. I always enjoy your show, and I enjoy all the really interesting things you dig into with your guests, so, you know, anytime.
Well, listen, dude, it's part of why I wanted M.L. Behrman on. I just loved the idea that he was kind of following some of the fictional storylines that you're famous for, including Dark Skies. And that was a breakthrough show in some respects. 25 years, it doesn't really seem like it's been that long. But looking back on Dark Skies, where do you see it fit in the sort of the paranormal media sphere?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I used to be the chairman of the Television Academy. And so,
yeah, you did.
As a consequence, I get to go to the Emmy parties and so forth. So I was at one last night for the performers, and a person who I don't know came up to me out of nowhere and says, you know what, Dark Skies is my favorite show. It was a great show. Well, now I don't even know this person. And I have that happen a lot because for a certain amount of people, and I'm sure that there's a number of them in your audience, it
right.
really did, check that box off. Because what it represents, and it is 25 years, I know time is flying faster than a tic-tac in my life, and
right.
it's pretty amazing. But 25 years ago, it was a landmark series because it was probably the most subversive on-air storyline
right.
that probably any network had ever put on at the time. And you know what? It's aged pretty well because it was set as a period piece. It took place in the 1960s, frankly. It starts during the Kennedy New Frontier and sort of tells the story of the UFO story through the eyes of a naive congressional aide who ends up becoming a Majestic 12 agent. So,
yeah.
it's going to always reach out to people because it's not going to grow out of style. And one
no.
of the things I think that is responsible for that is I think we all pretty much know right now that since the government is admitting for the first time very openly that these things are real and we don't make them and
right.
we don't think China or Russia makes them either, then that means that there's a whole lot of hidden history out there. And that's what
right.
dark skies traffic does.
Yeah. No, and crypto history is definitely one of these veins in the coast-to-coast corpus that we've been mining for a very long time. And I love it, and I also love the fact that it allows for such great creativity. And there are wonderful interpretations of this, and we have in your career, I mean, I could go through all the different things you did that were not necessarily paranormal, but hugely successful in their own right. And the fact that you were a CNN correspondent originally turned screenwriter turned producer. That's not something that happens very often. You do share, I mean, that idea that you were the first writer producer to be head of that of the Emmy Award since Rod Serling. Is that what it was?
That is correct. Rod Serling was obviously a kind of a writing hero of mine. He headed the Academy in the early 60s, and it wasn't until I was elected in 2001 that another writer got the job. So I've always been very proud of that. Of course, in 2001, it also meant that I took office just a few days before 9/11, so that kind of was a double-edged sword.
Yeah, and that you were the guy. You were the figurehead at the time when the Emmys had to be canceled that year
right.
because.
It's funny. History is a funny thing. 49 years go by, the Emmys were never canceled or postponed, and then I get elected, and in my first 2 months on the job, I canceled twice.
On your watch.
When we tried to do them on October 7th that year, we invaded Afghanistan that morning.
Oh, so, God.
We just kind of got.
You were a snake bit.
At the end of the day, are just an award, and you can live without them. So
yeah, you did the right thing. There's no doubt about it. It's just only from a fellow producer standpoint that I look at that and I just go, oy vey.
Because it's expensive. As well as I do as a producer that. Once you're wound up and you're ready to go, and production is imminent, one of the most expensive things you can do. Isn't going ahead, but it's stopping because you got to turn that cruise ship around and then you got to plan to get it back on the sea again. So it can be quite a problem.
I'm very minor league, but I was in a co-producer in a recent concert series that we put on here on the campus at Kansas State where I teach. And we had a 15-day out for an outbreak that if we had suddenly, if some variant came in and started to really affect the campus now that all the students were back, we only had 15 days out from the event to be able to get out of it without day 14, day 13, if there's a variant thing, we're on the hook for a ton of money.
I'm not sure people even, recognize, but one of the big parts of production is being able to read an insurance policy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. I was grateful I had more experienced eyeballs on that myself.
Right, absolutely.
So you're also recognizing, and thank you so much for coming on. We're talking with Bryce Zabel. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com and see all the cool stuff that he's done. And along with the anniversary of Dark Skies, that really it has, and this is what ML Behrman had mentioned earlier, it's been 60 years too since the Betty and Barney Hill story broke, and I think that in a way it's that's such an archetype for every right fiction and nonfiction narrative that has come out since then.
Well, first of all, you're right to be bringing up these two anniversaries. The Dark Skies one is a little more personal for me. But the Betty and Barney Hill anniversary, think about it. As of tomorrow night, it will be 60 years to the day that Betty and Barney had that missing time up in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. But when you say that it was the archetype, Ian, you've said a lot, because here's what's interesting about it. That has always compelled me. And it's because it's a case that's all about first, the first time for everything. It was the first alien abduction claim in the United States. It was the first reported case of missing time. It was the first use of hypnotic regression to recover abduction memories. It was the first public description of what we now know as the Grays. And it was the first time that a couple had claimed a simultaneous abduction. So, you know, you really got the template established with Betty and Barney Hill. And the reason I've been compelled to their case, not only as a journalist, but also as a dramatist, we're trying to turn it into a television series right now. But the reason I'm compelled by it is that virtually every abduction case afterwards had it to refer to. And I love going back to it because if Betty and Barney Hill, if you want to go with the binary choice that either they were lying or it really happened, if they were lying, they were making it up based on original material, and they were very creative because they didn't really have a lot of stuff to go on as we might now. Now, of course, someone who's claiming abduction, and I'm not saying that people are wrong about that. I'm simply saying that when someone does claim it, there's not only a lot of stuff in the literature, the UFO literature, but there's a lot of stuff that's been produced in film and television content over the years that's a reference material. So they were the first. That's why they're interesting.
You know, here's what's interesting about it to me. They were on the cover of so many magazines, and even, you know, into the 1960s and 70s, they were a subject of talk shows, and they were minor celebrities in their day. What struck me as a kid was that I had two grandmothers. My southern grandmother was very progressive, perhaps, and my northern Yankee grandmother was kind of hard right, and she was a seminal member of the John Birch Society, and you know, but she loved, and for whatever reason, it was my Yankee grandmother's fascination with Betty and Barney Hill. She would normally hated biracial couples and all of that. She was she had a very old world view of how that should be. And I'll just say it, she was kind of racist. But Betty and Barney Hill, she couldn't stop talking about them. Well, and that was interesting that it was that couple and their biracialness back then was part of the story, and at the same time got a total pass for people that just found it so interesting.
First of all, it's also what compels me because, Barney Hill was a black man, Betty was a white woman at a time, 1961, when this happened. Mm-hmm. Where, frankly, everyone who saw them on the streets first thought of their race when they first saw them.
Right.
Barney lived his life. They were both involved in the civil rights movement, and Barney pretty much knew that he was a target. He knew that, as a black man, he was clearly being looked at in a different way, and his life was defined by that. But what's interesting, on the night that they were abducted, it doesn't appear that the aliens cared what his skin color was. The only people who really seemed to care were people. And I'll tell you why this is your aunt who was
grandmother.
The
grandmother, yeah.
Your grandmother. Okay, well, you know what? I think I know what happened. First, the case happened in 61, but it wasn't actually publicized until the Boston Traveler's John Luttrell reported on it in 1965. And it took a year for that to become the book that John Fuller wrote, which is The Interrupted Journey. But what put it on the map wasn't just the fact that that Interrupted Journey book was a book club of the month kind of selection. What put it on the map is that it was excerpted in two issues of Look magazine. And, of course, you know, we all have the internet and everything else to keep
right.
us amused. But in your grandmother's time, Look Magazine and Life Magazine, those were the big ones. That's where you got your entertainment. And to have talk about an alien abduction in 1966 when that came out, that was mind-blowing, and it sounds like her mind was blown by it.
Well, and she had the subscriptions to those really quirky pulp magazines with, you know, they were, some of them were kind of fly-by-night, might be around for a year or two. And that's when I would go visit her. She had stacks of these UFO magazines. And otherwise, she was so not that way. But that story hooked her. And it became sort of formative for me because I would read those stories at night when I go to bed. I'd take some of the magazines. And she'd say, that'll scare you, but it's true. And I was like, okay. And I'd take them under the covers with a flashlight.
Ian, one of the reasons that your grandmother thought it was true, though, is also it was the because it was the first use of hypnotic regression to recover those abduction
yeah.
memories. You have transcripts in those articles of Betty and Barney under hypnosis, and they are clearly frightened and freaking out during
yeah.
hypnotic regression. And
yeah.
and today you and I can go listen to the actual tapes of those regressions.
And I have, yep.
And exactly, as have I. And I got to tell you, that would be a party sometime because
yeah.
they'll make the hair stand up because these people are clearly re-experiencing something that was deeply, deeply troubling to them.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear. I don't know if you caught any when I was talking with my friend Emil Behrman, and he was talking about the George Adamski story, which kind of happened, you know, they're sort of like West Coast, East Coast kind of thing. So here in the Mojave, there's all these things going on and all these people are showing up and looking at it. People are digging stuff out of the ground. And that, too, doesn't become a story until almost like a generation later or two before those stories start to leak out. And it wasn't like anybody was hiding them. It's just...
No, it wasn't. Although, and I'm sure we could do a couple of rounds in a later show. But the Adamski stuff from the 50s, the contactees, had a lighter touch to it. It didn't feel as real as the Betty and Barney and the abduction cases to follow, because in those cases, rather than aliens who wanted to talk to us and give us some good advice about nuclear power and so forth, Betty and Barney were the equivalent of medical experiments, and were treated in very much the same way that we might treat a deer, take it in, look it over, tag it, and put it back into the wild. That's kind of what happened to Betty and Barney, and I think that's why it's frightening, not just to them, but to those of us who have actually studied the case. It's a more frightening thing to experience.
Well, how is the market these days, if you don't mind me asking a inside baseball question? What is it like for you, even with your pedigree, to get a show sold that deals with the paranormal? Easier, harder, saturated, can't wait to get more?
There's more television and film being created than ever before, but there are more people now trying to sell it. So I've always looked at trying to sell in Hollywood to be a very competitive sport, and I've never been disappointed by that. You can have the best story around, but you're still going to have to put some shoe leather and work into trying to sell it. Now, I will say one thing about the Betty and Barney storyline, though, in that regard. I have the book Captured Under Option. That's the one that was written by Kathy Martin and Stan Friedman. And so we've been in the market and are more aggressively in the market today. It didn't hurt that the UAP report said this stuff is real, because that then tends to make other things feel more real as well. But I think the other thing that's happened, at the same time people are focused on the paranormal, if you're just talking about the UFO piece of
yeah.
the paranormal,
yeah,
people are focused on that because this whole UAP thing is breaking
yeah.
over us on a daily basis. But the thing that really elevates as a project, the Captured project, is the fact that Betty and Barney Hill had an entire separate life as civil rights workers.
Right.
And so you've taken and put two powerful concepts, UFOs and civil rights into an atom collider. And in the pilot that I wrote with my wife, you can really tell it is super energized by these two competing things being forced into the same story at the same time. But to answer your question directly, people are always very interested to hear about paranormal stories. I mean, that's how they get made. But the difference for me is when I was pitching Dark Skies in 1996, people at the network were like, wow, so you really believe this stuff? And, you know, and I would say, yes, I do. And I would tell them and they would listen politely. But I could tell that most of them didn't really believe it. They were just looking at the story I was pitching them as a story. The difference is today, you know, people have a passing passing sense of the information that is in the media, and they know these things are real. So when you walk in with a reality-based story, they want to hear more about it. So well, it is easier to pitch, even if it's never easy to sell.
Bryce, we'll consider this the pregame to another visit coming up, and good luck with what you have to do, because I think that's an important story and an important story to tell well, and I'm glad you're the one who's trying to do it, the 60th anniversary of the Betty and Barney Hill story. I hope you enjoyed that first hour. You're going to love the rest of the show, too. Coming up next with Mary Roach is back on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.